people who've never been to the con and seen the look on their face that was on my face, which is, my tribe, I have found my tribe. Like, it is a time when these people can express themselves in a totally safe environment, and it doesn't matter what they're a fan of. This is really the place where they can lay down their arms and come together and just be like, are we not dope? Are we not amazing for being this obsessed with something?
Writer-director Joss Whedon talking about Comic-Con in a documentary, and we're going to talk about the pop culture convention. It starts today, later on the show. But first, President Obama is in town. He is scheduled to speak at the Los Angeles Trade Tech College this afternoon. And the president has been calling a lot of attention lately to two-year schools like Trade Tech. At today's event, he'll talk about how community colleges provide essential job skills for a fraction of the cost of four-year colleges. But that isn't always true here in California. Our state enrolls a quarter of the country's community college students, and yet we lag behind other states in arming those students with the degrees employers want. Our community colleges are struggling in other ways as well. Nancy Schulock is executive director of the Institute for Higher Education Leadership and Policy at Cal State Sacramento. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, thank you for being here. And the president, as we say, has been talking a lot about the value of these community colleges as job-driven. How is California, though, falling behind in offering job-related skills?
Well, I think it's really exciting that the president chose to go to Los Angeles Trade Technical College. It is probably among our 110 colleges with the, they all have job training programs. It's, we call it the career technical education part of the overall mission of the colleges. But LA Trade Tech has probably the most comprehensive set of programs. And I think that a lot is happening. It's very exciting what's happening across the country to raise the profile. The president's definitely helping with that, of the career, the workforce mission of the community colleges. And it's also happening here in California. I think we are maybe a little bit slower to get to that point here because our community colleges have traditionally really focused on more heavily on the junior college, the transfer mission to our universities. And so although there's very large array of excellent career technical education programs across our colleges, they really haven't gotten the attention inside the system, I think, that they're getting now.
Right. I understand that accreditors have issued warnings to more than half of California's community colleges since 2003 for various reasons. Can you tell us why? Why are they getting these warnings?
Well, I'm sure it varies across all of the colleges. Some of it has to do with the severe budgetary constraints that the colleges have had to be operating under over the past many years, while, as you probably know, during a recession, enrollment tends to increase. So they're having increased enrollments, increased expectations as this whole national spotlight is being put on the ever-important role of the community colleges in workforce preparation. More students, less money, higher expectations. So I think that's a big part of it. Affordability and student debt has been a huge national issue. I think it's actually a lesser issue here in California than elsewhere. But so that's, I can't speak to the individual circumstances of the colleges and the accreditation situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's one college in particular that has received a lot of negative attention in San Francisco, City College of San Francisco.
Right.
And I don't know how indicative that college is of the broader problem, but in that case, 70% of the students there fail to graduate on time, only 14% transfer elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And by almost any measure, their practices, their academic practices are below par. Is that happening at other community colleges here in California?
On the San Francisco situation, I think the accreditation issue there is really not about academic performance. The community college system in California is actually doing an excellent job in putting out data on the campuses. The colleges all have report cards, and my understanding is that the performance and the graduation rates, the completion rates, are no different in San Francisco than many other colleges. I think colleges in California and across the country are being pressured to increase their completion rates, and they all are trying to do that. They have a lot of challenges because students entering the community colleges, which are what we call open access, students are entering seriously underprepared. The vast majority of students are underprepared for college-level work. So that, of course, is seeding all kinds of really important reform efforts in high school and high school to college alignment and pathways and all of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I understand California also is only one of two states that doesn't offer certain degrees, applied associate degrees.
Yeah,
is that
that's something we think it is, our institute here. We have raised that issue because, like I said, in California historically, because of the very highly esteemed master plan for higher education, it really set up in 1960 our community college system to be the primary pathway to the baccalaureate. In other states, you can go to a larger portion of high school graduates can go directly to universities, but here the community colleges were set up to serve the vast majority of the students. So that transfer mission has kind of taken precedence over the workforce training, the career and technical education mission. And I would say one of the casualties, if that's maybe too strong a word, of that is that we haven't put the priority on the kind of degrees that are valued mostly in the workforce for students who are not intending to earn a bachelor's degree. So we are one of two states that does not offer the applied associate degree. And it's something that we have raised that would be interesting for the state to look into.
But then, as I noted earlier, at least in the case of City College, only 14% do transfer elsewhere. So the transferring part, at least with that college and probably others, is not working as it was once planned.
Well, that is true. But there was a very important reform act passed, I'm not getting the date right, but I think about 3 years ago, it was SB 1440, and we did adopt in the state new associate degrees expressly for transfer. So there's a lot of work on that in recognition of the fact that as much as I've been talking about the need to focus more heavily on the career mission, the transfer mission is no less important. And a lot of work's been done. It's been deemed a historic transfer reform, and a lot of work is being done with the community colleges in partnership with the Cal State system to improve the transfer pathway. So I think you'll see those numbers start to increase everywhere.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us.
Sure. My pleasure.
That's Nancy Schulock. She's Executive Director of the Institute for Higher Education Leadership and Policy at Cal State Sacramento. And we want to know what you think about the community college situation. Maybe you are a student at a community college. What is your experience? Give us a call, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Well, some community colleges may be struggling financially, but they do provide a more affordable choice for a lot of high school grads who are facing an uncertain financial future. And with the cost of a college education going up so fast, students are graduating with a lot more debt. $1.2 trillion nationwide and growing. 90% of those student loans are financed by the U.S. Treasury. That is you and me. But a growing number of college grads are defaulting on their debt, and that's going to make it harder for them to buy a car or a house in the future, and that means it's going to have an impact on the broader U.S. economy. Barmak Nasirian is Director of Policy Analysis with the American Association of State Colleges and Universities in Washington. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, outstanding student debt has grown from $500 billion to, as I said, well over $1 trillion in just 7 years. Why so fast?
Well, that is a function of escalating costs on the one hand and stagnating wages and diminishing resources on the part of families on the other hand. So it's that gap between what people can pay and what college costs that is being filled with tremendous amounts of borrowing.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the cost part of it. Those costs are increasing faster than income, as we said, and inflation as well. Right. Why are college costs going up?
There really are two basic problems. One has to do with cost escalation with regard to expenditures. In other words, colleges and universities seem to be spending – a lot more than other sectors of the economy, and then they simply pass those costs to students. But there is a complementary reason, which I suspect is probably the primary driver in terms of the experience most people have, and that is cost shifting from the states, which used to subsidize public higher education, to students. So yes, actual costs are going up, and we could have a very complicated conversation about the underlying causalities, whether it's a matter of profligacy or poor choices, or whether there are some things that are endemic to higher education that may make it a little less efficient. But the crisis of affordability and the amount of borrowing we see is primarily driven by the fact that the states have gradually pulled back from providing the kind of operating subsidy that institutions used to receive, and that shortfall is being shifted over to families and students.
So fewer scholarships, in other words.
No. I'm talking about literal subsidies to public institutions. States generally subsidize
part of the cost. Right, tax
so if
dollars.
You go back mm-hmm. 30 years, over the course of the last 30 years, the number of students within the public sector has escalated by 62%, but the per capita subsidy has diminished by 30%.
Well, that is certainly the case here in California.
You're the poster child of that. That's true.
Right. So people are now comparing all the student debt to the subprime mortgage crisis, in the fact that students are maybe taking out risky loans to pay off their debts and might not be able to pay them off and be saddled with these debts for a very, very long time. Is that a fair comparison?
I'm one of the people who talks about the eerie and alarming similarities, but I want to be very clear. The subprime mortgage crisis, as enormous as it was, wasn't really the aspect of the financial meltdown that tanked our economy. Yes, subprime mortgages went into foreclosure at astonishingly high rates, but really it was regular mortgages, prime mortgages, that also ended up at way higher rates of foreclosure than expected. So the segment of the higher education market, quote-unquote, that I analogize to subprime would be the for-profit sector, where I'm one of those critics who sees mostly consumer fraud as opposed to real education, and those loans are absolutely headed for default, predictably very much the same way as subprime mortgages were headed for default. But the aspect of it that ought to be scaring us is just regular legitimate colleges overpackaging students with more debt than the degrees really justify. And it's not a matter of whether people end up defaulting. You know, people have families, people struggle. Typically, the consequences of default are so severe that most borrowers do everything they can not to default. The problem is when you tie a boat anchor around young people's necks right before they step into the market, into the labor force, you really change economic behavior. So they can't buy cars, they can't buy homes, they can't start families at the same time as they might have. And that's the ripple effect that I suspect many economists and folks in other sectors of our economy are worried about.
Right. And meanwhile, the price of homes keeps going up and up and up. So,
well, in some markets it does. In some markets it hasn't even recovered yet.
Yeah. So what is the solution then to this incredible amount of student loan debt that, you know, a lot of people won't be able to pay off or they'll be saddled with for the rest of their lives?
Well, not to take a dig at the administration, but the way I would characterize their intervention so far is they have understandably focused on making loans less painful. They've focused on making repayment easier. And that's a good thing. We need to do that because for that population, nearly 40 million people who are attempting to repay loans, obviously they're facing difficulties and we've got to do everything we can to make repayment less painful, more possible, more tolerable. But, you know, we need policies that address the cost disease of higher education, not policies that allow the cost disease to take its course and then on the back end simply intervene with regard to repayment. And that's where I just don't see any evidence of very serious work.
Barmak Nasirian, Director of Policy Analysis with the American Association of State Colleges and Universities in Washington. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
Well, how have student loans affected your life? You can leave us a voicemail, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can share your story with us on our Facebook page. That's KCRW Press Play. Well, coming up on the program, Comic-Con officially begins today. 130,000 people in San Diego for the next few days. We'll get a preview coming up on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and let's take a break from reality now and join the world of comic books, fantasy, sci-fi, and Hollywood. In other words, Comic-Con. Devin Faraci of Badass Digest is there in San Diego. Hi.
Hey, Madeline. How are you?
I'm good. So you're a veteran of Comic-Con.
I've been here a couple of times, yeah.
Yeah. And so how's it changed over the years?
You know, it's been kind of fascinating to watch it grow bigger and bigger and bigger. When I first started coming to Comic-Con, it was just this immense nerd celebration. And in the last few years, it's turned into, frankly, a grotesque orgy of consumerism and marketing. And it has been really incredible to watch that change from what was sort of a community-based celebration of popular culture into an immense advertising opportunity.
Right. So all the big studios are there unveiling their big, big, huge projects.
You know what? Actually, this year they're not, but they until this year they were. It had become sort of a cold war of everybody bringing their big projects to San Diego, and not even just their big comic book projects. Twilight was coming here for years. There was a lot of discussion about whether or not 50 Shades of Grey was going to be here this year. It had just turned into kind of a big movies convention.
So Star Wars, I understand the next Star Wars movie is not going to be unveiled there. And that's a big disappointment.
No, they're keeping that under wraps as well. There have been a lot of discussion about it. The first Star Wars was the very first major movie to come to Comic-Con and use this as an opportunity for marketing back in 1976. So there's a real history of Star Wars movies coming here. And we've been kind of wondering if they were going to be unveiling anything because this new Star Wars movie is such a mystery. But in fact, they are keeping it continue to be a mystery. And are not unveiling a single thing this year at Comic-Con.
So there's nothing related to Star Wars there this year?
Oh, no. Don't get me wrong. There is plenty related to Star Wars here, just not Star Wars Episode 7. There's all kinds of stuff related to Star Wars comic books, Star Wars cartoons, Star Wars toys, Star Wars breakfast cereals, anything that you want with Star Wars except Episode 7.
Okay. And also The Hobbit. The last installment is going to be unveiled.
Yeah, they are claiming it's the last installment. We're all hoping and we're all praying. But yes, this is supposed to be where they are going to reveal to us that our suffering ends with the final third Hobbit.
And Peter Jackson will be there?
Yeah, Peter Jackson is here to release us.
So I guess you're not a fan. I'm just intuiting that.
Oh, you know, I love Lord of the Rings, but these Hobbit movies, they've taken like a 135-page children's book and made it into 9 hours of enormous, tedious CGI battle. So I'm pretty much ready for it to be done.
What about the Avengers?
You know, there's a lot of rumors going on. Part of the fun of Comic-Con is surprising the audience about what they're going to be seeing. So there's a lot of rumors going around about what Marvel's going to be doing Saturday, which is their big day. They're, in fact, pretty much closing out the convention Saturday night. And I can tell you that Chris Evans is going to be here in San Diego on Saturday. He's going to be doing some press for Snowpiercer, which really indicates he's probably also going to be showing up at the Marvel panel and revealing either Captain America or Avengers stuff. But again, Marvel likes to keep it a secret and surprise audiences as much as possible. I was here the year when they brought out all the Avengers on stage, and just having all those actors stand together sent the 6,000-person Hall H just thunderous applause. They got so excited just seeing the actors. I'm kind of curious to see what Marvel does this year.
All right. Batman, he just turned 75 years old, senior citizen, and now there's a Batman versus Superman movie coming out, a TV series called Gotham about the years before Batman. Why so much Batman?
You know, Batman just continues to always appeal to the most socially maladjusted among us. People love a rich guy who punches poor people in the face. They just love it. And that's why Batman, 75 years in, continues. You know, I think it's part of it is that he's just sort of does the kind of things we all wish that we could do. He's a little bit tough. He's kind of a loner. And he's got a butler.
And he has a butler.
He's got a butler. Everybody loves the guy with a butler.
You said 50 Shades of Grey. It doesn't have a big presence there, but there is a trailer being released, I think, at Comic-Con, which seems a little weird.
Yeah, they're going to be using Comic-Con as a launch pad for the trailer, since all of the press is here. So half of Los Angeles' media presence has descended upon San Diego. They're going to be using Comic-Con as the launch pad for it, but they don't actually have a panel or anything. And, you know, same thing with Hunger Games. It's sort of a bummer. Mockingjay Part 1 is not coming down here, but they're going to be using Comic-Con as a launch pad for their big trailer this weekend.
So just walking around the halls of that convention center, is everyone dressed up?
There's a lot of cosplay happening here. I mean, the peak day for cosplay is, I believe, going to be Saturday when they have, there's like a cosplay parade and there's a costume contest. But even yesterday, it was preview night. There was nothing going on, and there were people in costume yesterday. It used to be that you would not see anybody in costume until Friday or Saturday, but Comic-Con, I think people are riding the train down to San Diego wearing their costumes. It really has become an absolute mecca for people who kind of hate their daily life and need to change into somebody else.
Are you dressed up as anything?
I'm dressed up as a guy who is dreading Comic-Con.
Okay, so you have your beard on, you got your plaid shirt.
Yeah, my beard is on. I am wearing the Comic-Con general uniform of a black T-shirt and jeans. This is the traditional garb of my people.
Devin Faraci, founder of Badass Digest, a website on movies, TV, games, and books. Devin, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on the program, Joe Biden. He's been described as the Betty White of vice presidents. His white tooth persona and Joe Bomb gaffes have won him a cult following, but beneath the hair plugs is a well of deep foreign policy experience. A profile of Joe Biden next on Press Play after a news update with Larry Perel.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and here's a video in which Vice President Joe Biden shows fictional HBO veep Selena Meyer, played by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, around the Oval Office.
Come on, right. let me show over here. That's where the president sits. This is where I sit. This is the vice president. Same exact chair. One big difference. A lot of power in that chair.
You got that right. I'm hungry. Are you hungry?
Come on, let's get out and get something to eat, okay?
Yeah.
And that's a goof video, of course, produced for the most recent White House Correspondents' Dinner. It got some big laughs. There was the vice president making fun of his real-life image as a cheeseball, pulling up in a ridiculous yellow sports car, aviators affixed to his perfectly tan face, million-watt smile a-flashing. I just can't imagine Dick Cheney pulling that kind of thing off. Not that he'd want to. But Vice President Joe Biden is a different kind of number two, one who's had to balance his reputation as a gaffe machine with his tasked mission of constructing the administration's foreign policy footprint, especially in recently reignited hotspots, Iraq and Ukraine. Evan Osnos is a staff writer for The New Yorker. His behind-the-scenes look at the Biden agenda appears in the magazine this week. Welcome.
Thanks very much for having me.
My pleasure. Well, you say in your piece that the vice president has spent a lot of this year handling the situation in Ukraine. And he was, you know, speaking with the former president, Yanukovych, trying to make him make up with the protesters who later overthrew him. He was on the ground during the turmoil. Why was he the president's point man for Ukraine?
Well, Biden has been involved with Eastern Europe going back to the 1970s when he was first elected to the Senate. He took an early interest in foreign policy. And as he told me once, if you weren't interested in missile defense and nuclear proliferation back then you weren't in the deal. That was the term he used. And that's really, for Joe Biden, that's always the most important thing, is to be involved in the issue that is the most in the deal. So when Ukraine began to boil over in November of 2013, there was a decision inside the administration that the person to build up a relationship and to try to navigate their way through that was going to be Vice President Biden.
And he made quips to some of the presidential hopefuls during the election a few months ago. He said, "I've twice been a presidential candidate, and I hope you do better than I did." I mean, how does he get away with that?
Well, this is the thing that's interesting about him. Certainly one of the things that made me interested in him as a profile subject. I mean, if you're going to spend 13,000 words on somebody in The New Yorker, you're looking for what it is that makes that person tick. And one of the distinguishing factors about Joe Biden, and this is if you talk to people all across the U.S. government and overseas, I talk to foreign leaders about him, they say that he is exactly what he appears to be. There is very little daylight between the public Joe Biden and the private Joe Biden. And so when we see him say things that sometimes can be hair-raising, he's doing that also behind the scenes, but it is in its own way enormously disarming. And so, for instance, he can go into a room in a way that a traditional diplomat wouldn't, and he'll say something to somebody like, as he did in Beijing, "If I had hair like yours, I'd be president." And what might be greeted in some places as, you know, "What's wrong with this guy?" In other places, they say, "Well, you know, that's who he is, and now I know exactly what I'm..." When he starts talking about substance, which he does, and is quite knowledgeable on the details, they know that they're getting the voice of somebody who's, one, telling them what he really thinks, and two, is speaking as close to the president as you can possibly get, because after all, he's number two.
Well, that kind of folksy joking around is something that the former president, George W. Bush, tried to pull off.
He did. And I've talked to people who interacted with both of them. And I have to say, I think part of the thing about Joe Biden that seems to work, and it works, I should say, it works in some places better than others. I mean, there are, for instance, I spoke to some of the Brits and the Germans who are less patient with this kind of folksy towel snapping that is a big part of his rapport. But in the Middle East, where you get a more dramatic, more overt kind of politics, where there's more of a sense of that you have to go through the rituals of trust building, some of the old world Wilmington, Scranton political rhythms work for him. To give you one odd example is that the Israeli ambassador to the United States, Ron Dermer, told me a story about when Joe Biden was in Israel, and he said to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, he said, "My father had a saying, which is, never crucify yourself on a small cross," by which he meant to encourage Netanyahu to take a larger political step. And Dermer said to me, "Look, picture this. This is a Catholic American vice president telling a Jewish prime minister in Jerusalem not to crucify himself on a small cross." And he said, and there was a moment of sort of awkward silence, and then the prime minister cracked up. And he said, "You know, the truth is that's the single most succinct description of Israeli political reality that I've ever heard, to the point now that Dermer uses it in his own speeches." So there's something about the way that Joe Biden goes about his diplomacy that is effective.
And it seems to be that his persona, and in fact not even his persona, but who he is, as you say, there's very little daylight between the two, is in direct contrast to POTUS, number one, Barack Obama, who has a very different personality.
Yeah, they do. And that was one of the interesting parts of this project. I spoke to President Obama about Joe Biden, about their relationship. And what came through very clearly is that the two of them figured out early on that they are radically different men. Obama, after all, grew up in Hawaii, Indonesia, Chicago. I mean, he was a child of the 70s. And Joe Biden, when he talks about his own life story, it really sounds like an Archie comic. It's about them going down and fishing at the river and stopping at the ice cream parlor and going home. And yet they figured out that they had these different strengths and weaknesses. And one of them, of course, is that Obama is depleted through interactions with other people. That's just a part of who he is. Joe Biden draws energy from it. You know, the longer the night goes on, the more people in the crowd, the more energetic he becomes, to the point that he has trouble going to sleep at night after he goes to a political reception. And Obama looked at that and realized, you know, I could use that, and I could that could benefit this team. And so for that reason, it's been a much more successful partnership than I think either man ever expected it to be.
Right. And so you say that he really relies, the president really relies on Joe Biden for foreign policy, for his foreign policy expertise. And in fact, that's why he put him on the ticket in the first place. And yet he has had to rein him in when he was running for re-election. He made Joe Biden read from a teleprompter just to make sure he wouldn't say, you know, utter a gaffe, one of his Joe bombs.
Right. It's, you know, we forget that when Barack Obama first ran for president, after all, he had very little foreign policy experience. He'd been in Washington only a few years. Joe Biden had been there for 36 years in the Senate. He was the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. And Obama really needed that. And so Obama said, look, I really do actually need this kind of foreign policy advice, very, very high up in our administration. And yet at the same time, there are things that Joe Biden does on the trail, on the stump, that make Obama real. I mean, Obama, he goes over, anybody, if you talk to any of his speechwriters, you know, Barack Obama goes over every syllable. He goes over every comma. He rarely, if ever, deviates from what's on the page. That's a key part of one of the reasons why he's been an effective speaker. Joe Biden is, he's uncomfortable with teleprompters, actually, because he was a stutterer as a kid. It still makes him uneasy when he has to read off of something rather than ad lib it. And yet, the administration decided early on that they couldn't afford to have Joe Biden extemporizing, making things up as he went along, so they tried to get him to use a teleprompter. You know, it's worked sometimes, but he still goes, as his staff puts it, off prompter now and then, and that makes everybody a little bit nervous.
But how does the president, and you did talk to the president for your article about Joe Biden, how does he balance these two sides of Joe Biden, the serious foreign policy expert, and then the kind of cheeseball, you know, as you say, grandpa just back from the gym who's sitting behind him during State of the Union speeches, winking and mugging and doing his little, you know, shooting his pistol with his fingers at people? You know, how does he balance those two sides of Joe Biden when he thinks about him as a trusted advisor?
The president, I think, is pretty dry-eyed about this. He decides what is the value and what, if, of course, is the damage that is posed by the Joe Biden vice presidency. So, you know, the damage in terms of the aesthetics, every once in a while, Biden will say something that is unhelpful. For instance, early on, right after they'd come into office, Biden said to an audience, if we manage to achieve 30% of what we're trying to do on the economy, that'll be a miracle, or words to that effect. And of course, that's not what Obama would have said. That's not the image. That's not the message he was trying to project. And so when Obama was asked about it, he said in response to the question, I don't know exactly what Joe was referring to, not surprisingly. And that was an important moment because the two of them got together for lunch shortly after that. And Biden said to the president, look, I'm sorry about what I said. That was sloppy. And at the same time, if we begin to look like we're sniping at each other, it's going to take this whole thing down. And we've got to figure out a way to get beyond that. And I think in some ways, you know, when you talk to the people who are very close to those two, and also when you talk to them directly, they'll tell you that they figured out early on that they had to come up with a sort of stylistic accommodation so that that didn't matter. I mean, look, in the end, a lot of the things that Joe Biden does, which are kind of laughable, don't harm the administration and what he brings to it in a positive sense, which is the things we've talked about. He's got this deep relationship with foreign leaders. He's got experience around the world. He's able to go to Capitol Hill and persuade people like Mitch McConnell to do things that the president either can't or is frankly uncomfortable or unwilling to do. That's important. And I think for the president in the end, he's willing to take some of those liabilities for the sake of getting the value out of that relationship.
Well, he's relied on Vice President Biden for some key foreign policy advice, including drawing down troops in Afghanistan and also in Iraq, supporting Nouri al-Maliki, who has turned out to be quite a fair weather friend and is now someone who is seen as largely behind the current chaos in that country. And so has it proved a little bit unreliable to rely on Biden's advice in foreign policy for the president?
Yeah, Iraq became Joe Biden's portfolio in 2009. Shortly after they came into office, there was a meeting of the war cabinet, and Obama turned to the vice president and said, Joe, you do Iraq. And from that point on, it was really it was Biden, and then of course in cooperation with the Pentagon and State Department and the other national security parts of the national security apparatus, figuring out how to go forward. And one of the decisions that he made was that he supported the Prime Minister of Iraq, Nouri al-Maliki. And today we look back on that and say that Maliki has turned the country in a more sectarian and authoritarian direction than we would have wanted to see. So in retrospect, there's no question that the vice president stayed in support of Maliki longer than was useful. And I asked him about it. And what he says is, look, it's easy for us now to go back and realize Maliki was a mistake. But at the time, what Biden was looking at was he believed, he made a judgment, he and his national security team, that Nouri al-Maliki was the most viable Shia candidate to lead the country and to be able to manage these multiple constituencies. Biden did things like he asked other politicians to stand aside from running, from competing against Maliki for the vote for the prime ministership, and asked them to take a lower position in the government. And today, when I asked him about it in the West Wing, he no longer signaled that kind of support for Maliki. I think he recognizes that the hopes he had for him were misplaced. This is an interesting question. How do you evaluate somebody's decisions over the course of 6 years in a job like the vice presidency? And earlier this year, you remember Robert Gates, former Secretary of Defense, published a book in which he said of Joe Biden that he's, as he put it, impossible not to like, but he's been wrong on every major foreign policy and national security question for 4 decades. And it was a really damning comment, and it obviously got a lot of attention. And when I talk to people across the foreign policy establishment, you talk to people who have been engaged in these kinds of questions over that period, and I think it caught a lot of people by surprise, because what they say is, as Richard Haass, who's the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, put it to me, he said, look, I've never known anybody who bats 1,000, and I certainly have never known anybody who bats 0. He said, Joe Biden's had his hits and he's had his misses, just like the rest of us. And I thought in the end that was probably a fair appraisal. I'm not sure you could say that Joe Biden has been wrong more than others have. But when he's been wrong, it has certainly been high profile.
Okay, let's talk about 2016 briefly. And he's kind of flirting, I think, with a run for the presidency, but won't do it if Hillary Clinton runs?
I think that's about right. That's the conclusion I reached. You know, Hillary Clinton right now has an almost unimaginably large lead. She pulls ahead of him by at least 50 points in every survey. She's been the most admired woman in America for the last 12 years, according to Gallup polls. If Joe Biden tries to get the Democratic nomination and fails, he'll be the first vice president since 1952 to do so. And so in a way, Biden, who's always had pretty good political instincts, is going to have to decide at a certain point whether he wants to take the risk of the embarrassment of going for the presidency and not winning it versus making a different choice, you know, deciding at a certain point that he would take on the role of a great statesman and say, I'm done with politics, I'm going to serve my vice presidency, and then wish the next president well. He hasn't gotten to that point yet. And I think it's interesting. You know, Joe Biden's been in politics for 40 plus years. He's never done anything else. And the idea of walking away when you're this close to the mountaintop, I think, is hard to do casually. And there's also a strategic reason for him to keep talking about 2016, which is he knows that the more he talks about it, as long as he keeps the idea on the table that he could complicate a Clinton candidacy, he keeps himself, as he would like to say, in the deal.
Evan Osnos is a staff writer for The New Yorker. His article on the vice president is called The Biden Agenda. Evan, thank you.
Thanks very much.
Well, let's find out what's on the Olney agenda coming up at 1 o'clock.
With that music, I felt like breaking into song. You know, I felt like I was being introduced to you know, hit the first chorus. We're going to be talking about fires all over the West, more and more every day, it would seem, that to qualify as large. what that's doing to the Forest Service, the Forest Service budget, not just for fighting fires, but also preventing fires in the future, because that's where they get the money to fight the fires for today. And anathema to environmentalists who might be listening to our program. We'll talk about the idea of changing our concept of wilderness that ought to be kept alone and not fussed with as under the Wilderness Act that was passed exactly 50 years ago.
Oh, okay. Very interesting discussion at 1 o'clock on To the Point with Warren Olney. Thank you very much. And coming up on this show, the longest rivalry in all of sports, the Dodgers versus the Giants. We'll find out how it all started back in the 19th century. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Dodgers are headed to San Francisco this weekend for a series against their arch enemies, the Giants. Their rivalry is one of the most heated in all of American sports. In fact, it may also be the longest. It began in the late 1800s when both teams were still based in New York, the Dodgers in Brooklyn and the Giants in Manhattan. Amateur historian and Giants fan Mike Schlitt is here to tell us more. Hi.
Hello, Madeline.
And can you be unbiased as a Giants fan?
Of course I can.
Here in Dodger territory?
Of course. I've been hiding in the woods this long, so yes.
All right. So how did this all begin?
Well, the two teams played in the World Series in 1889. The Dodgers were then known as the Brooklyn Bridegrooms. I think that's probably
when... The Brooklyn Bridegrooms?
Yes. Strange. I don't know the genesis of that name, but... So the Giants won that one, a best of 11 series. I think they were thinking volume. The Giants won that one. Brooklyn was the blue-collar city. Brooklyn was the underdog city. Brooklyn Dodgers were always known as the Brooklyn Bums.
Mm-hmm.
And the Giants, the elite power money in Manhattan. And, of course, the name, right, the Giants, you immediately conjure images of David and Goliath. They were one of the best teams in the league, and the Dodgers, the Bums, were one of the worst teams in the league. There was a very heated rivalry between the Dodgers owner, Charles Ebbets, and the Giants manager, John McGraw, who was not one of the nicest guys in the world. He was very competitive. His nickname was Little Napoleon.
And that gives you some indication.
Yeah, just to give you an indication. And he would insult the owner of the Dodgers, Charles Ebbets, who was at every single game. And he loved to, you know, scream profanities at him, tell him how rotten his team was. And yeah, I think cultural identity, geography, and the fact that at least starting that the Goliath team was so much better, and eventually parity came to be, and the teams were much more evenly matched as the century wore on.
But then, as the century wore on in 1957, Walter O'Malley moved the Dodgers to Los Angeles, and the Giants then followed suit.
Yeah, that's an interesting story, too, because it shows you how much things don't change over time. The issue in 1957 was old rundown ballparks. But this is when O'Malley realized there was just no way he could keep the team in Brooklyn. He had always been looking westward. He made deals with people in Los Angeles and the league, the National League, because at that time, the furthest west teams were in St. Louis and Kansas City. And the National League team said, well, no way, we're not going to let just one team go all the way west. You're going to have to do it in a pair. And that's when O'Malley convinced Horace Stoneham, the manager of the Giants, to follow suit. And they both moved together in 1958.
Okay, what is the highlight of this rivalry over the years, do you think?
I would have to say, well, the shot heard went around the world is probably one of the most famous baseball moments in history. That was 1951, Bobby Thompson's home run against the Dodgers. And that was a great year, too. I mean, the teams were sort of neck and neck. The Dodgers, they were, again, very evenly matched through that period of time. They're both still in New York. In August, the Dodgers were up 12 and a half games in the, I think, August 10th. And then the Giants ended up winning 50 of their last 62 games to tie it up. The last, you know, and back then there were no divisions. So it was National League and American League. Tied up in the last game of the season. They have a sudden death three-game playoff series. The Giants win the first game. The Dodgers win the second game, third game. Tied up in the seventh inning. Dodgers take a lead in the bottom of the ninth inning. It's 4-2. And Bobby Thompson comes up. They take out. Also, interestingly, this was Willie Mays' first year, rookie Willie Mays. So Don Newcomb had been pitching. He was tired. They take out Don Newcomb, and the manager of Dodgers brings in lucky number 13, Ralph Branca, who had given up a home run in the first game to Bobby Thompson. One day's rest he's working on, and they decide to pitch to Thompson because nobody wants to pitch to Willie Mays. First pitch is a strike, high and tight. Second pitch, also high and tight, and the rest is history. Bobby Thompson hits it out of the park, and we all know what happens next. The Giants win the pennant. The Giants win the pennant. And then go on to play the Yankees in the World Series and lose.
Oh well.
Yeah.
Okay, so if that's the highlight, what's the low light for this rivalry?
I would have to say that's probably 1965, the Juan Marichal-Johnny Roseboro incident, where, interestingly, this happened August 22nd, which was, I think, 11 days after the Watts riots. So things are tense in the city of Los Angeles.
This is 1965.
The two teams have been neck and neck all year. The Dodgers are playing up in San Francisco. They're a game and a half up. And the two best pitchers in baseball are playing Sandy Koufax, who's got 21 wins, Juan Marichal, who's got 19 wins. And basically what happens is Marichal comes to bat, and the catcher, Johnny Roseboro, throws the ball back to Sandy Koufax and brushes against Marichal's ear. Words are exchanged, and the next thing you know...
Well, we have a bulletin from San Francisco on the message board now, and I quote... Juan Marichal hit John Roseboro on the head with a bat following knockdown pitches to Wills and Merrily. Roseboro left the field bleeding over the left eye.
The entire bench is clear out, and it's a great piece of video, like 14 minutes of just guys just throwing punches at each other.
Oh, my gosh.
It was pretty intense. Giants win the game, but the Dodgers end up winning the pennant and the World Series, and you know, one of the best seasons the Dodgers ever had. Even though not good for Johnny Roseboro, but...
not good for the image of baseball either.
Not so good for the image of baseball.
Also, a bad off-field tragedy. Recently, of course, the beating of Brian Stowe, Giants fan.
Right.
By a couple of Dodger fans. He has been severely beaten. I mean, he is incapacitated for life. And then there was another... awful incident involving a Dodger fan who was stabbed.
Right,
to
there
death.
Was a stabbing death in the parking lot at AT&T
in San Francisco.
Park. I think in 2013. And you know, I mean, sports and cultural identification, and you know, things.
Do you think these rivalries stoke that kind of off-field violence at all?
They're not unrelated, but people get very excited about sports. They do a lot of drinking, and bad things can sometimes happen. It happens in other sports as well.
Okay, I know that I am stacking the deck a little bit, but since you are a Giants fan, I'll just ask you, which is the better team?
I'm not going to say that, Madeline.
This year, just
this
year.
Both teams are extraordinary this year. They both, all I can say is that rivalry is going to be really, going to have a really good finish this year, and I don't know who's going to win. If I did, I'd be a rich man.
Mike Schlitt, amateur historian, and not a rich man. And a Giants fan. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Madeline.
So I say D. I say D-O. D-O-D. D-O-D-G. D-O-D-G-E-R-S. Team, 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 team. Oh, I say O-M. O-M-A. O-M-A-L. O-M-A-L-L-E-Y. Oh, really? No O'Malley. Sandy Koufax, oh, my Drysdale Morey. Wills, I love you so. And we defy, defy the J-I, J-I-N, J-I-N-T, J-I-N-T-S. Giants! Play ball! Orlando.
I kind of didn't want that Danny Kaye song to end. Did you, Jolie Myers?
Maybe we can employ him as the feedback editor from now on. That was fantastic in every single way. And guess what? I hate baseball. And I enjoyed everything about that.
Really? Hate baseball?
Is that controversial?
I hate America's pastime.
Because it's not America's pastime. Have you ever heard of the NFL? That's what people are actually watching. That's the one that you can actually keep track of. Doesn't last for 6,000 months in the middle of the summer.
I have to agree with you.
It's the national nightmare. Is the time in between football and basketball. can't handle it. Sorry, I know that might be controversial, but alas, that's where we are. Student loan debt. You all have it. We talked about it at the top of the show. I know I can't make it through a dinner party or barbecue without hearing at least one conversation about how student debt is dragging a person down. It's like the new how's the weather sort of elevator conversation.
Right. I've noticed. Our guest said, it was like this millstone around people's necks.
Right. And Mackenzie Ritchie, she's one of those people. She shared her story on Facebook with us today. She says she has a promising career, that her college education has gotten her into the field that she wants to be in. All good so far. But she has $250,000 in debt.
Ooh.
8% interest rate. It completely dictates all of her life decisions. She says that whenever she talks about having kids with her husband or buying a house, the student loan factor comes up and it pretty much kills the conversation. So it looks like Mackenzie's got a tough road ahead of her. Good luck with the job, I guess, Mackenzie. But Jess Morales graduated from school debt-free. She worked a full-time job and two part-time jobs so that she could graduate without any student loan debt. So there's no debt crisis in the Morales household. I don't know, maybe they could get together and figure it out. But student loan debt, it's all over the place.
Right. And it's not just a problem for the students. It's also for the parents, who often take on a lot of that debt themselves.
Right. And not to mention the economy, which we heard. Problem. Like, if people can't, if they can't buy houses, if they are not spending their money because it's on student debt, I mean, kiss economic growth behind. Kiss
goodbye.
It. Goodbye.
There you go.
You're going to have to kiss me goodbye now.
Goodbye
too,
to you. Okay. And on that note, thank you, Jolie Myers. If you want to weigh in on anything, you can. Please, we welcome it. Our Facebook page is KCRW's Press Play. We're also on Twitter at KCRW Press Play. My personal handle at The Mad Brand. And you can leave us a voicemail, 1-844 Press Play. Warren Olney to The Point up next. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.